From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nature's sounds are all around us, from the woodpeckers in trees to crickets chirping in the grass. Legendary natural sound collector Bernie Krause has traveled all over the world capturing the symphony of nature. The sound of deserts, rainforests, glaciers, of wild birds, wolves, and orcas. He's with us today and sharing his vast collection. This hour On Point, listening to nature. You can join us on air or online. Do you crave the sounds of the natural world? Do you seek out those sounds? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Rohnert Park, California, is Bernie Krause. Since 1968, he's run Wild Sanctuary, traveling the world to record and archive sounds of creatures and their environments. His new book is called Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can read an excerpt from the book and listen to all the sound we'll play during this hour at our website, onpointradio.org. So nice to have you, Bernie. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Jane.
So we're listening here to early morning. It's Sequoia National Park in California, right?
That's right. It's a place called Crescent Meadow at about 6,700 feet. Mm. And this was a springtime recording.
When did you start collecting sounds from nature?
Well, I began my professional life as a musician with my late music partner, Paul Beaver. We introduced the synthesizer to pop music and film in the mid-60s. And our first album for Warner Brothers was an album called In a Wild Sanctuary, and it required that because of the theme of the album was ecology, it required actually that we go into the field to record natural soundscapes. Now, Paul wouldn't do that, so he left it mostly to me. And I marched off into the field not knowing very much about this, and the first time I turned on the recorder and I heard the lush sounds of the natural world, it just changed my life. I decided they were so beautiful that that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I tried to figure out a way to make that happen.
So how much audio have you collected?
I've collected over 5,000 hours of material, and I've got a wonderful archive. Unfortunately, about 50% of that archive comes from habitats that no longer exist.
50%?
Yes, but probably more than 50% now.
Hmm. Describe what a soundscape is.
Well, a soundscape is all of the sound that we hear at any given moment, and it's really divided into three sources, which are really the origins of the sounds, categories that I first identified. The first of those three categories of the soundscape is the geophony, or the non-biological sounds that occur in any given habitat. And they include the effects of wind in the trees or grasses, water in a stream, waves at the ocean shore, or movement of the earth. And long before any living organisms appeared on the earth, these were the first sounds that were ever created. Hmm. And the second of those categories is the biophony, bio meaning life and phone from the Greek meaning sound. And it's the collective sound made up of all the vocal organisms in a given habitat, whether they live on land or in marine habitats. And the third category is the anthropophony. Anthropo means human. So it's all of the sounds we humans make. And some of them are controlled, like music or language or theater, but most of them are random and chaotic and incoherent, other than the fact of their presence. And they contain no useful information. It's what I refer to as noise.
Hmm. Well, what I found so interesting, and you mentioned this just now, 50% of the sound that you've collected has changed. These soundscapes has changed or doesn't exist anymore. You talk about the comparative sound in the book. What it sounded like, you know, 50 years ago, what it sounded like, you know, a year ago. Let's listen to some of that now. This was audio taken in April 2004, 5 o'clock in the morning, about 50 miles north of San Francisco in Sugarloaf State Park, which is a low elevation mountain range on the border between Napa and Sonoma counties. You're near a stream. You can hear birds, dark-eyed juncos, golden-crowned and white-crowned sparrows, woodpeckers, so many others. Let's listen to that. 10 years later, Sugarloaf State Park again, 3 years into California's devastating drought, you barely hear the birds, and the stream is no longer flowing. Bernie, talk a little bit about those two particular sounds.
Well, it illustrates what's happened over time. At one point, this location in Sugarloaf State Park was very rich and vibrant with sounds of spring. And in 2015, pretty much that had begun to change partly because of the drought, but partly also because with global warming, spring is occurring a couple of weeks earlier every year. And this year, in 2015, there was absolutely no bird song at all where we live. It was a spring that was finally silent. Mm. And that's absolutely astonishing. It was my wife and I just sit there and shake our heads because we were expecting the bird song and it never occurred this year.
Here's another example of that. This is audio that was recorded a couple of dozen miles northeast of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, at Spread Creek Pond in June of 1981. You hear all sorts of beautiful sounds, yellow warblers, Wilson's warblers, house wrens, dusky flycatchers. Here's that. And then comparatively, because of global warming in 2009, spring started 2 weeks earlier than it did back in 1981. So vegetation was leafing earlier, was bringing a new mix of birds to the area. They are hermit thrush, yellow-rumped warblers, chirping sparrows, among others. Here's the sound. Quite a difference, Bernie Krause.
Yeah, and it was really surprising because when I came back to that habitat to record again in more recently, the entire bird population, the mix of birds has changed. And we think it's probably related to global warming, although we haven't really got enough data to establish that, absolutely. But we think that it's probably related.
Well, when we talk about protecting our planet, we don't often think in terms of protecting the soundscapes around us. This is an example that the healthier the habitat, the more musical the creature, right? Sound complexity is a measure of health. Is that right?
Well, density and diversity is very important to consider. And you have to remember that these soundscapes are a narrative of place. And each of these sources of sound contains fragments of stories that we need to learn about because together and separately, they give us new insights into biology, resource management, medicine, religion, architecture, physics, anthropology, and many other subjects. And most important, when we see through the lens of soundscape ecology, which is the new field that we're involved in, we get instant feedback as to how well humans are relating to their living environment through the multiple ways in which these vocal organisms collectively express themselves in the biophony. Mm. And by the way, almost anybody can do this, whether you're 6 years old or 60. The learning curve is very quick and sharp, and one can learn to do this work in these collections just really easily. All the technology is out there for us to do it. They're an instrument we can use.
You talk about the narrative of place in soundscape ecology. Give us a sense of where you traveled, where you have traveled over your lifetime in this career to collect sound.
Oh, my. Well, from pole to pole and most places in between, both marine and terrestrial. And it's been a wonderful journey. People often ask me what my favorite place is, and my favorite place is Alaska. Mm. I like Alaska because it's a huge area, almost a third the size of the United States. And it's got the longest shoreline of any state. And also, it's only got like 600,000 or 700,000 people in it. So you can travel long distances, as Bill McKibben says. You can go for 2 weeks in any direction and never hit a fence or a road, and there's no signage. And best of all, there's nothing to buy.
Favorite place is Alaska. What's your favorite sound?
Ah, my favorite sound. I don't have a favorite sound. I really like all of them that I record because natural soundscapes are really engaging and they're mysterious and they're wonderful. And it's a whole area that we're just learning about.
It's fair to say, I think, that you hear things the rest of us don't realize we're missing, right? And as I was reading your book, I thought, you know, we are so desensitized to the sounds around us. I actually went out last night and, you know, tried to hear what was around me. And we spend so much time trying to filter out background noise, don't we?
Yes, we do. And of course, it's really hard along the East Coast to find areas of quiet where you can actually hear natural soundscapes. But sometimes you can if you get up early enough in the morning.
We're talking about Nature's Symphony with natural sound collector Bernie Krause. And you can join the conversation. Where do you go to hear nature's sounds? Your backyard? Your local park? To the mountains? To the ocean? To far-off locations? Bernie Krause and English composer Richard Blackford collaborated on The Great Animal Orchestra, Symphony for Orchestra and Wild Soundscapes. It premiered in the UK in 2014 with the BBC National Orchestra. Here it is. It's beautiful. We go out with the first movement. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, much more after this break. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're celebrating nature's sounds this hour with natural sound collector Bernie Krause, and you can join the conversation. Have you heard changes over the years in the lushness of nature's sounds? Has development, global warming, human din muffled them? We're speaking this hour with Bernie Krause, author of the new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can listen to all the sound that we're hearing this hour at our website, onpointradio.org. We're hearing sound now from Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. It's a National Audubon Society sanctuary in southwest Florida. Here's audio taken in May of 1999. You can hear frogs and insects and birds, red-winged blackbirds, cardinals, blue herons, great egrets. The list goes on. Here it is. Bernie, you talk about the last 5 years' noise levels around us increasing, especially noise levels in our national parks. It's been an increasing problem to your mind. In your book, you write about how the Park Service has implemented a soundscape program. Talk a little bit about that and the importance of it.
Well, the soundscape program in the national parks is mostly dedicated to trying to figure out how to cut down noise in the parks. It began with overflights in Grand Canyon because people would go into Grand Canyon looking for quietude and some peace. And every time they would turn around, there'd be another tourist flight overhead. And so they started off trying to regulate those issues around the parks. And in the late 1990s, I got involved with the National Park Service and actually implemented a program for visitors, a soundscape program for visitors, to encourage visitors to go to places that were quieter within the parks to actually listen and record natural sounds. But in the previous administration, the Bush administration, they began to defund a lot of programs in the national parks, and one of those that got hit pretty badly was the soundscape program. And so they've concentrated mostly on the noise issues, straight piping motorcycles, jet skis, and snowmobiles. And they've managed to, you know, do some mitigation in that area. But it's still pretty noisy in the parks. And people just like to bring the noise with them when they go. They don't realize that that it's affecting not only wildlife, but it's affecting the ways in which we experience the wildlife.
You mentioned the you mentioned the snowmobiles in Yellowstone. You talk about that in your book. There has been a big battle over snowmobiles. You did a snowmobile noise evaluation, actually. Tell us what you found.
Well, what we found was that the this was before they did some of the mitigation. And what we found was is that they were extremely loud, and they were affecting, they were causing wildlife to become extremely stressed, even though a lot of the wildlife didn't know what to do behavior-wise. In other words, they didn't know what the reaction should be to the noise, even though the noise was very threatening or stressful to them. Hmm. And there were a number of studies that were done that actually showed in the stress levels increasing in the in these animals, wolves and elk in particular.
Here's some more comparative sound, Bernie Krause. The Lincoln Meadow at Yuba Pass is about 4 hours east of San Francisco. It's filled with ponderosa pine, it's lodgepole pine, red fir, white fir, Douglas fir, as well as some sequoias, actually. Here's some sound you took in the summer of 1988, where you can hear woodpeckers and mountain quail and chirping sparrows and Lincoln sparrows, frogs and insects. Here it is. Residents near Lincoln Meadow had been assured, actually, by a logging company that a selective logging operation would have no biological effect on the area. 1 year later, after the logging operation was complete, all you can hear is the sound of a stream and a woodpecker. Bernie Krause, described the differences in those two soundscapes.
Well, what was surprising was, well, first of all, I didn't go there to actually do a study. I just wanted to see what the difference in sound would be like. And I didn't realize that it would be that profound. But what we found was that the bird density and diversity, both the numbers of species and the total numbers of birds in that area had dropped off significantly. And in the past 27 years that I've gone back, the biophony, or that part of the soundscape which is generated by living organisms, has not yet returned. It's still the same 27 years later.
Here's Jerry calling from West Bloomfield, Michigan. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. So I live on 2.5 acres of wetlands, and we have many blue heron, as West Bloomfield area is known for them, for the nesting areas. And every July, we get about 55 of the cranes, and they continue into, you know, all through the summer, but they show up at night, and it's just beautiful. This time of year, I'm hearing a lot more sounds of different type of birds in the evening. It sounds like a jungle out there. And there's one bird that's making a sound like it's like being killed or something, but then it stops and it does it again, and I don't know what kind of sound of bird that is, but we also get like a deep-throated sound of maybe, I don't know if frogs or turtles make those sounds in the evening.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful place, Jerry, to live. I'd like to move out with you. Thanks so much for calling, Bernie Krause.
Well, I know Bloomfield Hills very well because I used to go to school there for a short time. I don't know what those critters are because I'm not familiar with the mix now. But my guess is because of global warming is that the populations of birds, the density and the diversity of birds, rather, will actually be changing over time there in Michigan. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Here's some more comparative sound, Bernie Krause. This is from coral reefs on an island in Fiji. Some living and some in the process of dying are already dead. This is a recording that was made underwater in October 1995 at a reef about 400 yards long. This part of the coral reef was quite alive, and you can hear many types of fish, damselfish, clown parrot, pufferfish, cardinals, goat, butterfly fish. Here's that. Here is the same coral reef, but at the other end, where it was bleached and had very few fish. That's quite remarkable, Bernie Krause.
Well, again, it's a narrative of place. These soundscapes really tell us how we're doing in relationship to our place in the natural world. And it's really clear. One of the things that I've noticed about this work is that when I go out and record in the field, I've found that no matter where you are, particularly in healthy habitats that are habitats that are still healthy, the sound begins to emerge following Darwin's timeline of evolution. And it goes like this. First, the insects establish their acoustic territory within the frequency spectrum, and then the reptiles and amphibians join the chorus. And once they're established, and they establish their niches, then the birds join the chorus, and finally all the mammals. And all the critters together creating not only frequency bandwidth, but temporal niches as well. And this is one of the discoveries that we're working on right now, and we'll be publishing on that very shortly.
What do you mean, temporal niches?
Well, when one bird stops singing and the bird happens to be covering a certain frequency niche, another bird will then take over. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, in the first 10 seconds, that bird will sing, and the next 10 seconds, another bird will sing to fill that same niche.
Mm-hmm. Here's some composite sound collected over 10 years from all over the world. It includes humpback whales in Hawaii, killer whales off of Vancouver Island, a dozen species of fish in the Caribbean. All this sound was recorded underwater in coral reefs and in the open ocean. Bernie Krause, you wrote about how whale populations are affected by a lot of things, but especially loud vessels. Give us an example of that from your book.
Well, when the propellers of boats turn, they put out what's called cavitation noise, and they generate a signal that's very, very loud, and sometimes it impedes the vocalizations of whales. Also, the sounds that the Navy is putting out for echolocation and the Navy signals that they're using for, to find out what other kind of vessels are in the area. And these are extremely loud, and they carry very long distances. And the whales aren't able to communicate between each other. And they're many species are very social animals.
And you talk about whales looking for acoustic shadows, right?
Well, I was referring to a study that we did in Glacier Bay in the late 1970s, early 1980s. And what was happening was the tourist vessels were creating such an incredible amount of noise that the thought was that the whale populations were beginning to fall off in Glacier Bay. So the very reason that the tourist vessels were going there to see the whales, and the whales just weren't there, even though there was still quite a bit of food. So the thought was that maybe the vessel noise, because there was a great deal of it, they had done nothing to mitigate that issue, was creating a circumstance that the whales were beginning to avoid it. And what we noticed was at many points when there was quite a lot of noise in the bay, the whales appeared to go behind islands so that they could get into a shadow of the noise, or they would get behind some of the icebergs that had fallen off the end of glaciers to try to find areas of silence.
Let's get Peter in here, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. Welcome to On Point.
Yes, hello. I was thinking two things. I spend quite a lot of time up in Canada, in Quebec in particular, and then I've been up around North Ontario. And because a lot of that land is protected, the world that Mr. Krauss is describing is so in evidence. And also here in Cambridge, as well as up there, I walk 3 hours before dawn. Yeah, the moon, the stars. You can even, if you go close to a lake, you can hear fish swim. Mm. You can hear those things. And there's just this riot of sound. And then I thought also of Alaska, and where a composer who just won the Pulitzer Prize, John Luther Adams, in his music, captures Alaska and this immense sense of open space, clouds, the whole landscape, and twittering sounds, you know, so on. And we should really think on this. Villa-Lobos did the same thing with bird calls. We risk losing this. I don't want in 100 years for my descendants to be staring at a landscape where the seas are swept clear of fish and the songbirds have vanished.
Yeah, and Peter, I think, Bernie Krauss, what you're saying is we already are losing a lot of those places.
We're losing a lot of those places. And also, I think, to the caller's point, Villa-Lobos and several other famous composers like Messiaen and others have really followed the older scientific path of separating out certain animals to illustrate in their music. I know I used to do that myself. For instance, I'd find a bird that was particularly musical, that fit the musical paradigms of the academy. And this kind of scientific way, this reductionist, abstract, fragmented, incoherent way of dealing with the natural world is really not what we want to do. We want to become a little bit more inclusive. And the reason that I've begun to record entire soundscapes rather than individual birds is to illustrate this more inclusive idea of incorporating and learning from the ways in which whole soundscapes express themselves. And with the symphony that we did, which you played part of, the Great Animal Orchestra symphony with BBC, that symphony really speaks to those issues. And by the way, we've also done a ballet, which was just at Jacob's Pillow, performed there this summer, that does exactly the same thing. The entire ballet was scored to natural sounds. Mm.
Let's play more of that sound going into the next break. But before we do, tell us a little bit about this Symphony for Orchestra and Wild Soundscapes that you performed with the BBC National Orchestra.
Well, Richard Blackford is a composer who was a composer in residence at Oxford University. And he read the book, The Great Animal Orchestra, and decided that maybe he could write a symphony to it. And so we collaborated on that, and he wrote most of the music in that particular one. And I contributed the natural soundscapes. And together we produced a symphony, which is the first symphony written that includes natural soundscapes as a component of the orchestration.
Here it is, the fourth movement of the Great Animal Orchestra, Symphony for Orchestra and Wild Soundscapes. Bernie Krauss is our guest. We're discussing the sound of wind, rain, wolves, birds, whales. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Hi. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about nature's song and how we need to protect our natural soundscapes. We're speaking this hour with Bernie Krause, author of the new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. You can listen to all the sound you've heard this hour at our website, onpointradio.org. This audio was recorded in March of 1991 on the Sakanya River in Borneo. A storm is coming through, and as the storm approaches, the insects and birds quiet down. As the storm quickly passes, they reemerge, and the birds you hear are ashy tailor birds, hornbills, white-crested hornbills. Bernie Krause, talk to us about the joy of this work. Why do you love it so much?
Well, for one thing, I have a terrible case of ADHD, which I've had since I was a kid. And no medication did anything to help me with that problem. And the only thing that has worked ever is being able to sit outside in the natural world surrounded by sound. And the soundscapes have done just about everything that one could imagine to ameliorate that problem. Mm-hmm. And by the way, just another side of that, the sounds that you were playing just as we came out of the break, excuse me, these were gibbons. And the Dyak, a group that lives very close to the natural world, think that the songs of the gibbons are so beautiful that they cause the sun to rise in response. So you ask about that. That's exactly what they do for me.
Mm. Here's some more sound. This is from Costa Rica. The Osa Peninsula, located along the southwest coast of Costa Rica, which is known, of course, for its rainforest. This audio was taken in April of 1989, and you can hear tree frogs, red-winged parrotlets, and cicadas. This second recording, also on the Osa Peninsula in Costa Rica, was made in 1996. Some clear cutting had begun, and the soundscape changed dramatically, with a significant drop in the abundance and the diversity of sound and wildlife. Mm. Bernie, it's almost gone.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, well, that's what happens. There's no home for these animals anymore. There's no place for them to find food, and there's no place for them to roost.
Let's go to Gary in Boscobel, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Yes.
I wanted to make the comment. I do some quite a bit of amateur outdoor wildlife photography, and not only are the sounds interesting, but I also live in a rural area in the Driftless region of Wisconsin. It's an unglaciated area that is probably 85% forested. And we still have a little bit of wildlife left there. Quite a bit of it has diminished and is gone. But not only listening to sounds when I'm out doing photography, but listening to the communication that's going on between species. And even in where I live in the country, around my house there, I have a number of family groups of different birds, blue jays and nuthatches and juncos and chickadees, and they're constantly communicating with each other, and it's not only just the sounds they make, but listening, trying to figure out what they're saying to each other. For instance, if I have a bull snake in the yard, it doesn't take long before one of those birds spots that, and every bird in the neighborhood is there to investigate and sound the alarm. This morning I had a Cooper's hawk, a young Cooper's hawk, around the house, and boy, it just raised heck with the neighborhood birds there. Everybody is on the same page when it comes to a predator of some kind. So the not only the sounds they make, but the communications that they're signaling back and forth are really interesting, too.
The conversations that they're having. Gary, thank you so much. What a wonderful call. Here's Russell in Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Russell. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Just a comment and maybe some food for thought for anybody with an elderly parent. But my mom lives back in Dublin, Ireland. She's 86, and her hearing has been deteriorating for years to the point she's driving us all nuts, telling us to speak up. So my sister eventually cajoled her into getting a hearing aid. And when I was back there recently, I was asking, you know, how is it? And she said to me, I can hear the birds. I thought they had all got away. And I just thought it was such a poignant thing that, you know, so sad, first of all, that she'd missed this in her life. And then I guess the joy of the redemption. And she was like a little kid when she could hear them again. And it was just something really, really special. So I just wanted to share that.
Ah, wonderful story, Russell. Thank you. Thank you very much. Bernie Krause?
Yes, well, it does the same thing for most people. These sounds are really palliatives. They're healing sources for us. And the further we draw away from the natural world and natural world experience and get involved in all the technology that we're so committed to these days, the more pathological we become as a culture. And just take a look around us. Just listen to the news and you'll see how that plays out.
You write in your book about the Japanese medicinal practice. It's called Shinrin-yoku, which literally means taking in the forest atmosphere or forest bathing. This has become a cornerstone of preventative healthcare in places like Japan and South Korea.
Yeah, exactly right. And it can do that for us here as well. You know, Richard Louv wrote this book, Last Child in the Woods, and he speaks exactly to that subject of how it's really important for us to get our kids out into the natural world and give them that experience and let them hear that voice, because it's so necessary for our lives and thriving.
Bernie, here's a recording you made in March of 2003 at dusk at the Chickasahatchee Wildlife Management Area in Georgia. It's a swampy area close to about 200 miles south of Atlanta. You can hear gray tree frogs, chorus frogs, southern leopard frogs, American green tree frogs. There's that. Let's go back to the phones. Bill in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. Welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane.
Yes.
I've got the pleasure of experiencing a lot of soundscapes that I may never encounter again, and your show is making me realize that I don't have to leave them behind. wondering if Bernie could recommend any equipment to start collecting soundscapes.
Well, there's a lot of equipment, and it ranges anywhere from $150, or you can use your iPhone, by the way, from $150 to many thousands of dollars. And one of the things that folks in the audience might want to know about is a chat room called Nature Recordists at yahoogroups.com. And Nature Recordists will give you all the information that you need because it's a worldwide group. There are a couple of thousand people on that list, I guess. And they all know a great deal about the very current technologies that one can use. And I would recommend Nature Recordists at Yahoo Groups for anybody who's really interested in following this up.
Bill, thank you so much. Here's Elizabeth in Bloomington, Illinois. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I live on a very, very busy street, so we have a very strange habitat in our front yard than we have in our backyard. And we have some woodpeckers, which I just love. But I have multiple sclerosis, and I have a problem with sensitivity to hearing. And so we have a lot of cicadas, And I'm going to go against the grain here and say I would really like to get rid of some of the sound. And I was just, I'm not asking to do that. But I was just wondering, why would that be? Because basically at night there is no other sound that is heard. And is that, would that be a lack of predators, or why, or just living in, you know, Midwest Illinois?
Elizabeth, thank you. Thank you for the call. Bernie Krause.
Well, we've had a great impact on the natural world, and we've kind of upset the balance of things. And one of the things that we really find is irritating is the fact that some of these sounds are overwhelming to us now. And we've got to pay some attention to that. What kind of world do we want to live in is really the question.
Here's more of your audio, Bernie Krause. This was recorded in Zimbabwe in September 1996 at 4:20 in the morning. Baboons barked at a large rock formation, using the face of those rocks to create a reverberant theater for their sounds. You can hear owlets, freckled nightjars, cape turtle doves, ground hornbills, bearded robins. Here's that. Ah, there he is again. So you've seen a lot of action over the years, Bernie.
I have.
As I read in your book, you've been attacked by spitting cobras. You've been approached by a polar bear, thrown by a gorilla. Talk about some of your adventures.
Well, my worst experiences have been in Hollywood. So,
and that's another story.
That's another story. Yeah, I'll stick with the animals. I'm still alive. I haven't been hurt in any way. And I really find working with within the animal world something that's so life-giving and exciting that I can't imagine doing anything else. This has been one of the great experiences of my life.
Is there evidence that you found that animals adjust their sounds to mimic human-made sounds, like the sound of boats or airplanes?
Well, there is some creatures. We've got a mockingbird in our backyard that actually imitates the sounds of trucks backing up. They go they imitate. There are some birds that are mimics that do that kind of sound imitation, but for the most part, the birds find their own voice and they pretty much stick to it.
I've got to get this one in. This is audio you recorded. Actually, this is audio recorded by a musicologist named Louis Sarno in the Central African Republic in April of 1994. It's in a swampy area that forest elephants go to in order to congregate and also to cool off. Sounds ominous, Bernie Krause. What do you hear in that?
Oh, they're just having a good time, and they're socializing, and they're communicating with one another in a very friendly way. There's nothing ominous about that one.
Here's Megan in Buckrow Beach, Virginia. Hi, Megan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say, growing up in Buckrow Beach, we had various birds, and we just loved the sounds, and now we're strict with strip malls and noise, and I just can appreciate all the work that he is doing, and I just wanted to tell him that I am teaching my granddaughter the outdoor sounds in the yard with the birds and at the beach.
Mm. Megan, thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Michael in Canton, New York. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Jane, and thank you, and thank WBUR for making it possible to hear from Bernie. I'm calling really just to, it's honorific to hear him. He's been a huge influence on my life and a huge influence on the life of a number of sound recordists that I know, and you know, that idea of a nature recordist thing has really blossomed in the past few years, and it's all owing to Bernie's work in the late 1960s and through the 70s when we all got onto him. And I was especially interested in what he had to say about the mistake of a reductionist approach to, you know, isolating mm-hmm. animals and like, rather than the whole thing. You can certainly find that out. His website is wonderful, Wild mm-hmm. Sanctuary. And I urge you to go there. And also, there's a Wikipedia description of his idea of biophony, which is quite profound.
Yes. You talked about that at the beginning, Michael Krauss, Bernie Krauss. Michael, thank you so much for the call. We're short on time here. We could go on and on. Tell us what we lose when natural soundscapes disappear.
Well, you know, biophonies are really important to us and vital to preserve. And this may be our last chance to hear the real voice of the divine.
The divine music of the natural world. Bernie Krauss, author of the new book, Voices of the Wild, Animal Songs, Human Din, and the Call to Save Natural Soundscapes. What a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go out on the final movement of the Great Animal Orchestra, Symphony for Orchestra and Wild Soundscapes, performed by the BBC National Orchestra. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.